All right, welcome everybody. My name is Curtis Sawn. I'm with Microsoft Consulting Services, and I am what's between you and food. So, while we have a small audience, just to make sure that everyone gets the food on time, if you have questions, just wait till the end, please. I would love to answer questions about this topic, for good or for bad. I can blah, blah, blah for quite a while. So feel free to come up afterwards. So what we're going to talk about today is what we're calling the modern approach to Office compatibility. And when we talk about compatibility work or a compatibility project, really it's making sure that the right stuff works in the next environment, right? Positioning yourself to make sure that you're ready for the next environment, be it Office, which is what we're talking about today, Windows, IE, or whatever the next platform or the next environment is. The goal of this session is to position you to deploy Office faster and with lower risk. Right, and the benefits there is lower costs mainly, and a lot less time that it will take. This presentation was derived from a workshop that I helped put together with our Office product team, that we built and delivered about 300 times since it was released in October of November, including myself and our consulting partners. So what I might be interjecting is a bunch of anecdotes from customers. That we've delivered this to, and we'll talk about what's worked, what hasn't worked, where we've gotten some really great feedback, where we've gotten some pushback. So basically, the good news is this stuff is what we're evangelizing and what we're using in practice. It's not just a bunch of conceptual mumbo-jumbo. It's a technical term. All right, so here's what we're talking about today. Basically, we're going to review what we see as the traditional approach to getting ready to deploy Office. Then we're going to talk about the more modern approach. We used to call it the agile approach, but that's an overused buzzword. So the goal is to make you more agile, but we've rebranded to the modern approach. So we're going to talk about what's the modern approach, contrast and show some of the differences between that and what we see as traditionally used. Then we're going to dig deep into what the details are, right? We're going to talk about what it takes or what you need to do pre-deployment and what can you wait to do or what you need to do post-deployment, right? We're going to talk about proactive testing and remediation versus reactive testing. Which one makes sense? And finally, we're going to be talking about, throughout the whole session, we're going to be interjecting some use of tools, right? This is not a tools-focused session. The goal is not to say, I want to position you to use these tools better, because I firmly believe that's the wrong approach. So throughout all these topics, we're going to be talking about, hey, where do our tools fit in? Where are they really good? Where are they not so good? What's the appropriate and inappropriate use? All right, so first of all, let's take a look at the traditional approach. What we find is that a lot of our customers start with, let me find everything, right? Let me find out what's my current state, get as much information as I possibly can. And then you start reviewing all that information for issues and then criticality. In fact, we see that done in that order, right? People use our OMPM tool a lot, Office Migration Planning Manager, to find all their stuff. Then they start categorizing, you filtering it, but it's based on the categories that it provides. It provides red, yellow, green information, which is great. And so people say, you know what, I'm going to focus on the reds first. Then they start worrying about, okay, which ones of those red things are important? Right? Then they start testing those, right? Testing all my red stuff, testing all the things that meet my criteria. Then they start keep on testing. I'm going to move down to the yellows. I'll move down to other things. So they find everything, they filter things, we filter things down, and then we start testing and testing and testing. What we're finding, and I'll give you answers to these questions, it's really not a cost-effective approach, right? And the goal, and really not reducing the risk too much. If you're using tools and criteria inappropriately, you're not really reducing your risk. And that's really what a compatibility effort or project is. It's really a risk management project, right? You want to make sure that you are cost-effectively managing your risk to make sure that you're able to migrate to the new environment in the cheapest way possible while keeping your risk low. Sorry, that's very important too. So the benefits of this approach, right, is you get to manage your risks, right? At least that's the mindset. What's the phrase? You can't manage what you can't measure, right? So you get as much information as possible, get as much information about, hey, what's my current state? That's going to help me predict, well, what do I need to go to next? Here's my current state. Now I'm better positioned to go to my next state, right? And the IT group in general is tasked with keeping the lights on, right? Managing the environment, right? And sometimes I equate IT, being IT is like mowing the lawn or cutting your grass, right? People only tend to notice when you do a bad job. Or like being in food service at a conference, right? Who cares how much it takes or what it takes to get bacon for 8,000 people? People are only going to notice if there's no bacon, right? So sometimes it's a thankless job, but the goal is that people just expect their things to work, right? And IT has to manage those expectations, right? So that's why you find as much stuff, you start testing everything, get as much information as possible, because you want to have zero surprises during a deployment, right? I'm going into a brand new environment. There's some risk there. I want to reduce my risk as much as possible. I want to find everything. If possible, I want to test everything, right? And also what we see is there's a heavy use of tools, right? The volume of stuff that you have with related to Office is just immense, right? And the best use of tools, or tools are great because they can help automate gathering and analyzing all that stuff. The pitfalls of that approach, this is the big one, for larger companies like 30, 40, 50,000 and up, we see it takes about 12 to 18 months to get ready to deploy Office, or almost any platform, right? 12 to 18 months to get ready. Right, before you start deploying your first seat, a year and a half. Our goal is really to cut that time in half without increasing your risk. That's going to save a lot of scratch, a lot of money. Right, and so the challenge is, or a couple challenges, if it takes so long to migrate to new environments, then you're really hindering your business's agility or their ability to respond or enact change in their environment. Right, and then you get into a mindset, oh, it took me so long, it takes the last time to migrate, I'll just wait till the next version. Which is common, it's not that that's bad. In fact, I've delivered this workshop 10-ish times, and every customer but two were migrating from Office 2003. One was coming from Office 2007, one was coming from Office XP. But it's not unusual. Also, when you scan or you're looking for all your stuff, what you end up doing is you're treating all your stuff equally. You're taking out the importance of that stuff when you're trying to find it. As an example, I've been with Microsoft for about 5 years, and just last week, I looked at my redirected my documents folder and found that I have 1,200 Office documents. Right? One person, 5 years, 1,200 documents. Right? 21 of them had the word resume in them. 15 of them were my resume. Right? So does it really make sense to spend a lot of effort to find all of my 1,200 documents? Oh, for those listening, the answer is no, if you're listening on this and recording. Right? So and scale that up by, what, 5,000, 10, so 10,000 user environment. What we tell people is to expect, if you want to estimate how many documents you have, start with the number 500 per user and then scale up. Depending on your industry, that might be more. Right? I have 1,200. But if 500 documents per person, and you're talking about a 10,000 user environment, that's what, 5 million things. Right? And what can you possibly do with 5 million data points? Anyway, so that's the challenge, is right, you're not getting any, you can't measure the return on your investment of your inventory activities if you don't know how important they are. So what we see is that people spend a lot of time, just trying to find out what they currently have. And the challenge with overusing tools is that although people use tools generally to provide direction and guidance, if you're not using them appropriately, or using them not for what they intended for, they can probably provide misguidance or misdirection. And we see that a lot with some of our tools. In fact, I'm going to off and on bash and celebrate our OMPM tool. Right? It's great for what it does. It's horrible for what we see it used most of the time. And again, the big problem with the traditional approach is it costs a lot. Right? The time it takes to get ready is costly. And so that's our goal, is to position you to reduce that deployment or that evaluation time at least in half. All right, so the more modern approach, on the surface, it's not that much different. The biggest difference is the first item, discovery. We are advocating discovery, not inventory, right? So you discover what's important to you, right? And we do that with a user-centric approach. We're recommending to talk to the business first and pretty much say, hey, what does it take to run your business that involves Office solutions, right? So we are definitely advocating against starting with finding everything that's out there. We've seen that, and it doesn't necessarily work that well, doesn't reduce risk. And we'll certainly talk about why. Then we start rationalizing or prioritizing, well, hey, what do I want to worry about first? Base it on business impact, right? Doesn't sound like it's too crazy here. Based on business impact, what has the largest scope? What affects the most people? What would cost the most money if it weren't working? Right? And that's what we're advocating, is identify, discover what is critical, the critical things, Office documents, solutions, macros, apps, add-ins. Identify the critical stuff, and you proactively test and remediate those solutions, right? Only the things that on day one of your deployment cannot be broken at all. And we're advocating proactively testing all your important, critically, specifically identified critical stuff, and reactively testing and fixing everything else. Once you deploy, then you can start to get better value out of your environment. You start managing your environment. You respond to any issues that may pop up. And regardless of how much planning and inventory work and testing work you do, there are going to be unknown issues that pop up. That happens with any rollout, almost with any product. And you need to respond and plan for that appropriately. And so once you have Office 2010 in your environment, then you can start saying, well, hey, how can I get more value out of my investment? Oh, and let me take a quick break. This workshop, when we designed it, was designed, and what we're talking about today is Office 2010. But you can certainly take these same concepts and apply it to future versions of Office, right? So Office 15 is in technical preview phase. It's not beta anymore. And I think it's going to be in public beta or public preview later this summer. So these same concepts can still apply, right? And that was one of the important design concepts when we built this workshop, is that we want to make sure that what we're talking about today does not expire. Right? It's going to still be used in future versions of Office. All right, so what does this look like? Basically, from a workflow perspective, what you do is you start with your project team or your strategy team, and you start getting together, you identify all the different business areas that you want to talk to, and to each one you say, hey, business, what does it take to run your business? What Office solutions does it take to run your business? What's critical? Right? What are really important to you? And you have that same conversation with each different business area. And yes, we have seen that it's a lot more cost-effective and a lot more efficient than trying to find everything for them and saying, hey, here's a list of all the stuff we found. Let's figure out what's different, or what's important. And then what you do is once you've explicitly identified everything that's critical, you start proactively testing, or before your deployment, you start testing only those critical docs. And then you can add them to some type of knowledge base. So in the future, you might not have to do this discovery as much, right? You're identifying an opportunity to bring these Office solutions under more IT management. After you've tested your critical things, then you start deploying. Right? In fact, my group, we act not only as delivering and building workshops, but also as an internal escalation point. And what we have found is that the biggest problem people have in migrating to versions of Office is getting started. We tell people, hey, start deploying. If you run into issues, call us. This is what we tell people internally. Never get called. Once people start deploying, they just go. So after you deploy Office, users are going to start using their stuff, their old stuff in their new environment, right? And they're going to call the help desk. Hey, where'd my print button go? Hey, I can't do whatever, right? And so you need to position the help desk to reactively test and fix those things, right? And it's not more unusual than what you do today, right? My first IT job ever in 1997 was on a help desk, right? And the requirements in the newspaper ad was you must know Excel and networking, right? And I had one of the two at that time. But that's the point, is that help desks are uniquely positioned to handle reactive remediation and testing. That's the requirement. So basically, that's what we're trying to advocate, is you proactively test things that are critical, specifically identified critical applications and documents and solutions, Office solutions. You reactively test via your help desk everything else. And we're going to talk about how you can prepare and augment your help desk just for that. Once you're done with the deployment project, and I'll stress this again, once you're done, then you can start to think about some optimization techniques. How do I want to get value out of my investment? Document conversion is a great example, right? Another spoiler alert, document conversion should not be the end goal of your Office deployment, right? I'll probably say that about four times today, but please decouple document conversion from your deployment effort. It is a post-deployment and optional post-deployment step. So then you determine, hey, with your project team, is document conversion something I want to do? This is something our tools are great for. You can actually determine, hey, is there an ROI? Is there value? Is it worth it for me to convert my documents? And I didn't say convert all my documents. We don't recommend that either. And then you can start doing the bulk conversion of all your documents to figure out, hey, you can get that. If the ROI says it's good, right, hey, I can save you 1.3 terabytes of network storage. Hey, is that something that you'd be interested in? Depending on the environment, maybe. So that's what we're advocating, is you identify tasks and activities that are deployment enablers, and those are your pre-deployment tasks and activities, right? Things that are only on the critical path to getting you ready to deploy Office 2010. And then post-deployment is then we talk about stuff, well, hey, what can I get more value out of my investment, right? Document conversion is an example of that. So we separate activities, pre-deployment, post-deployment. Right, so the typical first step we see for a lot of customers is they start scanning all their docs for issues. Right, and these are very sarcastic air quotes. And so I haven't talked about that yet. So what we're recommending is scanning your docs for issues is a post-deployment step. And big reason is because the ROMPM tool set, which scans documents for issues, scans for document conversion issues. Right? It helps answer the question, what's my risk if I migrate to the next, or excuse me, if I migrate this file to the OpenXML file format? Right? It does not answer the question, what's my risk if I open this file, or 1,000 files, or 1,000,000 files, up in Office 2010. It does a very bad job of trying to figure out, well, will this document work in my next in Office 2010? All right, so now we're going to talk about, in a little more detail, what are we talking about? What are your pre-deployment activities, right? What should you do proactively? What do you need to do to position yourself to get ready to deploy? And the first thing is discovery, right? The traditional method is more inventory, right? You start with that big circle of here's what I have. And the goal is use some type of filtering technique to get down to that smaller circle of here's what I need. Right? So the inventory, find everything, and then you use some rationalization or filtering techniques. So you go from what I have to what I need. Right? The challenge with Office is that the amount of stuff is just huge. So your circle of what I need is really a lot smaller. And I don't know if any of you can see that, but it's a terrible dark green circle. Small circle. So the challenge is, or the big problem is, if you start with what you have, you're going to spend a lot of time finding out what you have, when the value of discovery is to figure out, well, not what I have, but what do I need? And that's what we're advocating with the more modern approach, is start with your business areas. And the biggest reason we offer that is because typically Office solutions aren't managed by the IT group, right? With some exceptions. But a lot of that's one of the benefits and frustrations of Office in general is you can develop solutions. They can just grow organically in your organization, right? Some guy can hire an intern. They can create this great Access database or this Excel macro. You can use a macro recorder and things just pop up. It's a wonderful development tool, low barriers for entry, which can frustrate the IT department because they're not generally Office solutions aren't generally managed. And that's why we're advocating start with the business areas first, because they're not traditionally managed. And that's another key tenet, is we're advocating discovery, not inventory. Start with what you need. Discover what's important, not what you have. Because your goal of discovery, the end goal is to figure out, is to feed your testing. The end goal of discovering is to figure out, hey, what do I care about? What do I need? Because those are the things that you want to test, your critical solutions. These are the things I need to run my business. And that should be your goal of discovery, not figuring out, hey, what's out there, but figuring out, what do I need to test? All right, so it's easy to say, hey, you know, only find your critical things. But that is one of the statements I got the most feedback from customers. Right? And I had a guy at an insurance company in Connecticut say, hey, listen, he was either a project manager or a developer manager in the business. And he said, listen, we create things for a living and we make money doing it. So obviously we create things that are critical or else we wouldn't be in business. The guy next to him said, yeah. We let go of those people last year, and last year's downsizing. A lot of good laughs. But the point was this. How can you tell me that some of the stuff that I create isn't critical? That's what he was, I think, trying to say to me. I couldn't tell if he thought I was being condescending to him or he was being condescending to me, but his point was valid. We create critical stuff or else we wouldn't be in business. So the example I had where I found 15 copies of my resume on my Documents folder. The day before I go to sign up for or post for a new job, one of those copies may have been critical. The day after, I don't think any of them were critical, right? I'm not looking for another job. They're really not that critical. So every document, solution, whatever, has a lifespan of how important it is. So he's right. Everything he may have ever created could have been critical at one time. But when you're going to migrate, well, what does it take to run your business? And this is an example from an IT perspective, what really is critical? And it's really from an IT perspective, well, what has to be working, right? What do I need to keep functioning at all costs, no matter what? Those are the things you want to proactively test. And if there's things that, hey, yes, we need to use them, but, you know, I'll fix them if someone calls me about it, those are the things you reactively test. Then there's dozens of things, millions of things probably you'll never, ever test, you don't ever care about. 14 of my 15 copies of my resume. I bet none of you care about any copies of my resume, but 14 of them I definitely don't care about. Right, so that's from an IT perspective. From a business perspective, this is a formula that I got from my coworker, Chris Jackson. He put it on his blog site. Is really what is a critical application or a solution is something that it makes sense It is worth it to test, right? So the cost of failure of that solution times the probability of failure is more than the cost of testing. Yes, then it makes financial sense to actually test that application before I deploy. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense, right? An example he put out on his site, which I love, was let's say I've got a $100 get out of traffic court free card, and I'm willing to sell to any one of you. Would it make sense to buy it to get out of a $50 speeding ticket? Right? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to pay more to avoid a risk than it does to run right into that risk. Pay the fine and move on. Another example I think he also said was, does it make sense to buy a $101 insurance policy on a $100 bill? Actually, I said that just a few weeks ago to a customer. They said, hey, that's like a reverse Groupon. And I told her, I said, I'm going to steal that line. That's great. And again, so some things, it doesn't make sense to avoid a risk if it costs too much. So again, these are, you know, and it's really hard to determine what's the probability of failure of any solution, right? How do you measure that? And it's almost impossible to measure. So it's more of a mindset to get into. What is testing really worth it? Another much easier way to shortcut, is it really critical, is ask the customer or the business, well, what's in your disaster recovery plan? What office solutions are part of there? If the building you're working in suddenly becomes unavailable, you need to work off-site at your home at a different building. What office solutions have to be there in that new location? Right? That all your critical applications, regardless of office or not, should be in that DR plan. All right, so we've said this a lot to customers, and some people say, listen, I can't just ask the business. I can't go with nothing. I've got to give them something. Right? So is there anything I can do from an IT perspective beforehand to get people ready so I can engage the business better rather than saying, hey, listen, I don't know what you got. Just please tell me. So sometimes tools can be helpful during the discovery and the rationalization components, right? And again, your goal of using tools in your discovery process is to automate getting to the point of, hey, what do I need, right? So the big risk is anytime you use technical criteria, no matter what criteria it is, to derive business value, because right, the goal of discovery is to figure out what's really important. If you're going to use any type of filtering criteria based on technical means, you're adding degrees of separation between that business value and the technical criteria you used. Right? So if you use, I'm going to search for all documents that have been created in the last 3 years. Well, you're going to find a lot of stuff. You're going to get a lot of false positives. Right? So using any type of filtering introduces the risk of false positives and false negatives. Right? So if you find everything, or you find things that have been used or created in the last 2 or 3 years, you're going to get a lot of false positives, which means a lot of stuff you're going to discover they really don't care about. You're going to waste discovery and testing cycles. The flip side is false negatives. If you use filtering criteria and you filter out things that are important, then you run the risk of not discovering things that are really important. So using any tool includes these risks. So the recommendation, if you're going to use a tool or you're going to use technical criteria, make sure it is closely aligned as possible with business criticality, or else please don't use it. It's almost the same as being just choosing some arbitrary criteria, right? Because if you're adding too many degrees of separation, right, then it's almost the same as saying, well, I'm just going to look for documents that start with the letters D through G. And believe it or not, that's almost like what using OMPM is to help identify, well, what will work. If you're focusing on documents that have red conversion issues, but you're really focused on, well, what's really, you know, what's going to break when I open Office, when I use it in Office 2010, then it's really using arbitrary criteria. At another customer, I, as I walked in the door, I said, hey, listen, I hope you talk about OMPM today because, you know, I installed it, I scanned all the stuff in my home drive, I found 80 red things. I opened them all up and they're fine. What did I do wrong? I wanted to give her a big hug. If it wasn't so inappropriate, I would have done it right there. So, it was great because she kind of drove home the point as, well, her goal was to use OMPM to identify what's going to break, right? And it didn't work well for her. So she thought she was doing something wrong. So a silly example of using bad criteria to help your rationalization or discovery efforts is ice cream. Let's say I got to go to the ice cream store to buy ice cream for my wife, right? And she said, hey, honey, go get me ice cream. Or maybe I offer it because I'm, you know, that kind of guy. And I go to a store, it's got 50 different flavors, right? I can't possibly look. I don't have time to look for 50 different flavors. I got to reduce this some. I got to figure out what she wants, all right? So I got to get rid of 50 flavors. So being a super smart guy, I assign a number value to each of my 50 flavors, right? And you say, you know what? I'm going to speed this up by getting rid of all ice cream flavors that have a number assigned to them that aren't prime numbers. Huh, How awesome is that? I just reduced my result set by about 70%. Now I've got 13 or 14 flavors to look at. Great. This is a lot easier for me to get ice cream for. So how much closer am I now to actually figuring out what ice cream does my wife want? Right? I've reduced my chances, and I've filtered out a lot of stuff, but it would have made a lot more sense if I said, hey, honey, listen, what flavor do you want? You know, just to actually ask her. Right? And anything that says peanut butter probably would have been good. Oh, what do you know? I got lucky. Should have done this demo a little bit better. So anyway, so that's a purposely silly example of using inappropriate criteria. It can be the same as chance. So if you're in discovery and you want to use tools, what are the good ones? What are the bad ones? So we definitely recommend OEAT if you want to discover add-ins and interop apps. An interop app is something that programmatically interfaces with Office. Right? OEAT helps discover add-ins and interop apps. Right? And it actually uses usage as a technical criteria. Right? So how many people, if you're discovering interop apps, how many people are actually using this solution? That is a great way to derive business value. Not perfect, but if it's being used, you can actually say, hey, this is actually, you know, something that people are using, must be important. It also uses installation count, or how many instances of this solution are in the environment, as a means to detect add-ins. Right? So that's a pretty good way to derive business value. I've got a 10,000-person environment, and one add-in is installed on 8,000 computers. Does that mean it's important to the business? Maybe. That's a great starting point. It's not perfect, but it's a good starting point. Maybe it was part of my operating system image that, you know, I just never got out of there. But actually, that is a pretty good criteria to use. OMPM, I do not recommend at all to use during discovery. Right? During the discovery and rationalization phases, please do not use OMPM. Again, the reason being is it discovers document conversion issues. Right? It answers the question, what's my risk if I convert this file to the latest file format? Not what's my risk if I open this file in Office 2010. There are about 30 issues, I think, that it scans for Word, Excel, and PowerPoint documents. 27 or 28 have to do with document conversion. So it has a very, very limited use when trying to use it as a, hey, will it work? And it ends up leading to drawing to the wrong conclusions. And in some limited scenarios, it can be okay. This is based on some feedback we got and more discussions we had with some of our customers. So first, I want to talk about OEAT because that's great, right? Discovers add-ins and apps. Some requirements of it is if you're running it, you have to run it on users' desktops on all the endpoints. I don't recommend you install it everywhere. You run it everywhere. You run it on a sample of your clients. You need to run it under the user's context in order to detect add-ins. Most add-ins are registered in per-user mode. So if you run it under the system account, then you're not going to get it. You're going to miss a lot of stuff, right? Also, if you want to detect interop apps, you need to run it with admin rights. Because what it does is it sets security on certain registry keys, and that's how it detects, hey, is this app programmatically interfacing with Office? So if your end users don't have admin rights and you wanted to scan them both at the same time, you can always use group policy. You can set those auditing policies ahead of time. Use group policy to turn on auditing, and then you can get around the admin rights requirement. Again, for add-ins, it determines the count or how many installations of this add-in are out there. But for interop apps, it determines usage. Right? Two pretty good, actually, usage is a great technical criteria to use for filtering to help derive business value. Oops, wrong mouse. All right, so basically what we recommend, and one of the great things about OEAT is the data that comes back. Right? It's a pretty simple step to execute it on users' desktops. An exe with an XML file, it's configuration, that's it. You just run OEAT-scan, and then all the results get written back to a central share that you can define, or central location. You compile that results in a very easy-to-consume Excel spreadsheet, and it's organized automatically by installation count or by usage count. So step five, if you can see the numbers, not very well, is once you get that data, then you can bring it to the business and say, hey, listen, I've got a list of data sorted by installation count or usage. Let's figure out what's important. And from there, the good news is that the data that comes back, again, discovery, the goal is to figure out what do I need to test. Well, the data returned by OEAT also provides users and computers. So you can figure out, okay, not only what apps are important, you can help derive what apps are important, you can say what users are good test candidates, or where are these add-ins installed so I know where I need to test. So it goes a step beyond just discovering what's important or helping you to determine what's important. It actually identifies, who should be the testers. And there is a user's guide online at TechNet. Again, it's very simple to use. And it doesn't tell you about identifying the users or computers, but that's actually bonus information that the tool provides. OMPM is a tool set that it's not just a tool. It actually scans, analyzes, and converts documents. That's the goal of the tool, is to assess document conversion issues from all your stuff out there and tell you, well, what's my risk if I convert this stuff? And the biggest tangible benefit of the tool is the OFC, Office File Converter tool, which helps you convert documents in bulk. You can use it in two ways. You can point OFC, in a sense, to a location or locations and say, convert everything there. Right? That's the high-risk way of doing it. Or you can use the OMPM tool to filter all your stuff and identify, well, which ones are good conversion candidates, and then say, I only want to convert those files. I'm going to talk about that more, actually, in a little bit as well. During discovery and inventory, the biggest misuses we see for OMPM, the most common uses for it, or unfortunately the most common uses, as an inventory tool, right? It is a great tool to tell you what do I have. But then you got to think about what's the value of getting that information. Right? So a coworker of mine worked for a government agency about a year ago, and I can't remember the exact numbers. It was either 6 million documents, it took them 8 weeks to discover it, or 8 million documents in 6 weeks, one of the two. Anyway, but he spent six to eight weeks trying to find 6 to 8 million documents, got them all into one or more OMPM databases, said, here you go, customer. Like, great, thanks. Never used that data again and moved on. And that was a horribly great story, and it demonstrated what we see as the most current use of it, is finding all your stuff and checking that box that says, you know what, I found it. I've got that information just in case. And we're talking about in huge environments, the cost of just in case can be huge. So 6 million documents, six to eight weeks or something like that. It was pretty bad. All right, so alternatives to using OMPM or OMPM alternatives is what you can do is scan recently accessed files. Let's say I only want to discover what I've used in the last 2 or 3 weeks. Then you can say, hey business, here's things I notice you guys are currently using. It doesn't say how many people have used it, but you can say, I only want to scan things that have actually been accessed in the last few weeks. That's one way to help derive business value, but keep in mind that also introduces the risk of false negatives. Right? You could miss things that are really important if I scan to the last 2 or 3 weeks, maybe there's an app that's only used at quarter end or year end or tax time, or if you're in retail, the holiday season. So there are some risks there. And there are some settings in the configuration file you can use to facilitate that. Another thing that we also recommend is if you have identified your critical files, you can put them in a location and use the OMPM tool to scan only those critical files and provide additional information. And really what we find, it actually really provides additional assurance. Right? It provides people that comfort level that, hey, I have used the tool to get information that you can't otherwise get, and now here's that data. And what we see that used most is to provide that reassurance. The value out of it, how it's going to help my deployment efforts, not so much, but the comfort level of, hey, yes, you've provided me information, now I can move on with my project, that's what we see it used the most for. And if you want to scan recently used files, another option is Xcopy. Right? Xcopy has what, 20, 30, 40, 50 switches? You can get a directory list of, say, here's everything that was used in the last 2 or 3 weeks. And it executes about 50 times faster than using OMPM to get that information, if you're using OMPM just to get what files were accessed recently. So I'm going to talk about more about document conversion after when we start talking about post-deployment work. All right, so after discovery, feeds testing, right? The goal of discovery, figure out what's really important so I can figure out what do I need to test. And in general, there are only three types of tests you can do, right? There's some automated testing. Use a tool to help say, hey, to help better estimate, is it going to work? We already talked about how OMPM is often used in that manner, and we definitely recommend against that. Doesn't do a good job at help predicting, will my stuff work in Office 2010? Then there's smoke testing. And the goal of smoke testing, what you do is just install and launch that solution and really poke around. The goal is to surface anything obvious. Hey, I noticed when I hit the print button, I get an error. And basically that's also done typically by the IT group. And the main reason to do that is to demonstrate to the end users that you are actually cooperating with them, that you are partnering with them in the testing efforts. Because really the only way you can unequivocally determine, does my stuff work, is to use it. Right? So end user testing is, okay, the only test that matters. Right? No tool is going to unequivocally answer the question, will my stuff work? Right? Tools can certainly tell you, I have passed or failed these 50, 100, whatever, this finite list of checks that I know how to check for, but it won't be able to unequivocally tell you, hey, does it work? Right? Does my chart look right? Does my app produce my financial statement or my insurance claim form correctly? So the goal of smoke testing, again, is to surface those obvious things that's going to help your end users in their user testing. And everything that is deemed critical to your business, that's in your DR plan, right, that has been specifically identified as this is critical to my business, should be tested by end users, should be user acceptance tested. And the big reason why is the goal of your testing efforts, when you're migrating platforms, migrating to a new environment, is to figure out, hey, does my stuff work? Right? Is it compliant in the environment that I'm moving to? Right? And that's what compatibility work is all about. I've got my existing stuff. I need to make sure it works in the next environment. And that's what the goal of UAT, user acceptance testing, is to make sure you can do your job using that solution, that document, that app. So the biggest challenges, and this is another point to help drive home why user testing is so important, is how do you prove something is compatible? Right? How do you prove it's compliant? There's only one way, is to actually, hey, do your work. Can you get your job done? Right? And so who knows how to do the work? Well, obviously, only the people who do the work. Sarcasm intended, right? So, and then the most important thing is if there's everything else is broken, right? You got a bunch of bugs in your solution, but it doesn't prevent you from getting your job done. Do you care? How important is that? So for instance, in smoke testing, we identified, hey, when I hit the print button, I get an error. Well, let's say to use this application, you don't ever print. Is that a deployment blocking bug? Do I need to fix that immediately before I deploy Office so I can use that solution if I'm never, ever going to print? And again, when you start talking about in scale, 5,000, 10,000, 50,000, 100,000 users, that do you care for non-deployment blocking bugs, that can be very costly, right? Can you really afford to care about things that really don't impact the ability to get your job done? For example, Office 2010, released in 2010, right, 2 years ago. Since then, since its release, we've provided hot fixes, cumulative updates, service packs, right? And service pack one fixed, I don't know, hundreds of bugs, right? So there was a product that we released that had hundreds of bugs in it. But how did those bugs impact your ability to get your job done? And there may be one or two, hopefully only, that said, yes, there was a bug that was blocking me. I couldn't get my job done because of this specific bug. But if they didn't get your job, if they didn't get your impact your ability to do your job, what's the big deal? Right? Can you afford to care if there are things wrong that have no impact in your work? All right, so that's why creating a user acceptance test environment. What the IT group can do is provide an environment that makes it easy for end users to test. Right? So end user testing, user acceptance testing, the only way to unequivocally determine my stuff works or your stuff works. Right? And users are the only ones who are positioned to do that. Right? The IT groups in general know how to use, I don't know, 1-2% of the applications that they need to manage in their environment. Right? Only the users know. There's no business value in the IT group knowing how to use all that stuff. So what we certainly recommend is leverage virtualization to provide a UAT environment. Right? And the benefits there is it provides that ability to rapidly provision and reprovision that testing environment. Right? So I give virtual machine one. Give it to Sally over here. Hey, do your testing. When you're done, let me know. Okay, hey, I'm done. And Sally says, okay, great. So now I'm done. And all I do is go click, click. And now that machine, a few seconds later, is available for someone else to test. So I've got a virtual machine. I've got a UAT environment that now I can make use of for a dozen more, two dozen more, 100 more instances. Right? And to provide that scale and that reach, if you have some type of centrally hosted environment, a Citrix environment or a VDI, then you can really scale that out a lot. In fact, there was a financial company in Connecticut and Switzerland, I think, that they actually skipped discovery. For months, they tried to scan all, 90,000 people, I think, tried to scan all their stuff. Couldn't do it. Couldn't find all their central shares. Right? And they asked the business, hey, listen, we can't do it. Can you help us identify which ones are important? No, we don't have time. Right? They couldn't ask the business. The business was not being very cooperative. So they went the other direction, or they went a different direction. They said, okay, they actually created a 2,000-seat Citrix environment they created 2,000 instances of Windows 7 with Office 2010. And then what they said is, okay, hey, Business Unit X, for your 3,000 people, it is what, July or June 10th, we are deploying Office on October 10th. Here are 300 virtual machines for you, 300 Citrix instances. Go test your stuff, and you have until September 10th to let us know if anything works. Everything fails, and then we'll help you. Here's the process that we're going to, the remediation process. Here's the testing process that we're going to do. It was a self-service method of providing testing and discovery. Basically, it was like just-in-time discovery. They forgot about find everything for them or asking the business to find for them. They said, okay, you've got 3-4 months to test. And then forced the business, empowered the business to identify what's important to them and only test those things. And it worked great. And it was a really great story. And that solution scaled well. Now you may be thinking, hey, a 2,000-seat Citrix environment, that's a pretty major cost. And you're right. The infrastructure to provide that could be significant. So definitely leverage what you have and piggyback off your existing infrastructure. But a couple goals of UAT is to make sure your testing environment, first of all, is as production representative as possible. Right? It's a very difficult conversation to have if someone says, hey, why did it work in test and fail in production? Right? That's a finger-pointing question. And someone's always looking for who's going to be the target of that finger. So you got to make sure your testing environment is either in your production environment, maybe it's in a separate OU that's managed separately, or in a domain or an environment that is closely representative of production, has access to all the data sources you need to access, or all the back-end connectivity. The other important thing is to make it easy, right? Reduce as many barriers to user acceptance testing as possible. The reason being is the hardest part about UAT is getting people to UAT. Right? I don't have time to test. I got better things to do. Right? So if you say, hey, listen, I've got this virtual machine sitting at my desk. Come on over and just log in. I got your stuff set up. Just go test it, and then you can go back doing your job. Oh, okay, I'll come down in a little bit. Right? It's very easy to ignore that conversation. But if you say, hey, listen, I sent an email that you click a link, automatically opens up an RDP session, remote desktop session, that logs on to essentially hosted Windows 7 machine with Office 2010 with the stuff already provisioned, very easy for them to test. Even better, maybe a SharePoint portal instead of just an email that provides that link to open use remote desktop to log in or maybe automatically provision a UAT machine. So remove as many testing barriers as possible to kind of eliminate the challenges that end users have in testing. And you're right, testing is probably not part of their job. And it's very easy to say, I ain't got time. So remove as many barriers as possible. But the importance of testing can't be overstated. Right? It's the only way to definitely determine, does my stuff work? And this is outside of just Office, when you're migrating to any new environment. All right, so discovery and testing are pretty much the proactive or the pre-deployment tasks you need to do. So then let's talk about the reactive tasks or the post-deployment stuff. Can you do not just in post-deployment, or how do you position yourself to handle post-deployment issues, or how do you position yourself to reactively remediate things? And the first thing is get your safety net ready, right? So what you can do, what we recommend, in any platform or environment migration, there's always a level of uncertainty, right? Oh, I don't know if things are going to work. What if, right? And so many people can bring up so many what ifs there can be a lot of fear, ambiguity, a lot of unknowns. Oh, I don't know what to do, right? So that's why a lot of people try and find everything is to reduce that ambiguity. But if you have a conversation that says, listen, we're going to migrate to a new environment. We are confident that most things are going to work. In fact, virtually all things are going to work. If it doesn't, here's our backup plan. Here's our mitigation. Right? So at virtualization, as an example, you can create a virtualized package of Office 2003, 2007, whatever you currently have. And if you can say, hey, listen, we're going to migrate you to Office 2010, but we have your old environment set up already. So in case there's any problem, we can get you up and working immediately. Right, using app virtualization as a mitigation allows you to position yourself to get the users productive immediately. While then you can remediate, if there's a problem with the code or problem with the add-in or the app, you can remediate that or buy the new version with normal priority, right? Rather than treating it as a fire drill. Right? Managing fire drills is not fun. You end up losing your hair. So that's one way. App virtualization is a great way to prepare that safety net, prepare that virtualized package of that legacy environment. Some flavor of OS virtualization as well. You can create a Citrix session. Oh, here, just click on this shortcut, it'll automatically open up Excel 2003 in a centrally hosted environment. That's another way. Also, making sure your help desk is positioned. Right? At a healthcare company I worked with in Minnesota, they had a 90,000 person healthcare company. And we start talking about, you know, hey, getting your help desk ready and augmenting them and make sure you got it. And they said, oh, stop. We already got that covered. And they pretty much were able to show me what the rest of the presentation. What it was is they got, I think they hired 22 or 23 contractors for the duration of their rollout. 16 level 1, 6 level 2, and I think they were just interviewing for the 1 level 3. And so temporary contractors were a great way to augment their support staff, support desk, with, hey, listen, I'm hiring people that specifically know about Office to help handle potential increased call volume. Right? Other options, you can definitely get your help desk early on in the pilot group. You can give them the interactive guides. And if you've seen them, they're awesome. They are a Silverlight-based an app that will show you where did my Excel, for instance, Excel menu and toolbar command, where was it in Excel 2003? Where is it in the ribbon? If you haven't seen it, they're fantastic. You can give the help desk those interactive guides so they get any calls of, hey, where'd my print button go? You can say, you can walk them through over the phone and say, oh, hey, here's how you do it. You can navigate it here. Right, and also what would be great is if you can position your help desk to deploy that safety net. Right, and that really is about how the software management is enacted in your environment. Right, but if you can get your help desk to deploy an app virtual package to your clients and you can resolve those potential issues on first call, that's a great way to increase confidence of the business that, hey, you know, we're going to be charging ahead into a new environment. We've got a backup plan. Right, the IT group has positioned me, the business, to make sure that I'm productive just in case. It's a really easy conversation to have once you have that safety net in place. Not only are the interactive guides good for the help desk, you can also give them to the end users, right? So they are locally available, or you can download a copy and install them to just any other MSI package. And what I've done with customers, is modify the setup programs to create a shortcut within the Microsoft Office help folder on the start menu. So that when you deploy Office, you're actually giving them a self-help means. So they call the help desk for the first time and say, hey, you know, how do I do a mail merge? I don't know where it went. The help desk can walk it through over the phone and then say, hey, listen, you have the ability to do it on yourself. In an outsourced help desk model, you can definitely quantify how much a help desk cost calls. And reducing that during a platform migration can be a significant cost savings. And obviously keeping your users productive. All right, now document scanning. When I bring this up with customers, this always gets either a lot of attention or people don't care, which is it's very polarized. It's pretty cool. So there are two main benefits of converting your documents. One is to leverage new features, right? So you can't use SmartArt with a .doc file, right? You can't use Sparklines with a .xls file. You've got to convert it to the new file format, then you can use those new features. However, it doesn't make much business justification to convert all your old stuff, just to use the new features. Right? I've created 1,200 documents, so I found out. Why would I need to update all of them just so I can maybe use new features on some of them when I go to use it? Am I going to use all 1,200 in the future? No. I hope not. Goodness, I hope not. It would make more sense if I'm using one of those documents I've already created. If I want to use new stuff, I'll just hit Save As. Right? And that's, in a sense, what document conversion does. It's a bulk. A document conversion in bulk is basically a bulk save as. So leveraging new features as a business driver to convert all your old stuff, that probably not that great. Right? You can do just-in-time conversion if you're going to use anything you've already created. It makes a lot more sense. And that's the goal of compatibility mode in Office 2010, is to open all your old stuff without a problem. And we've seen success rates between 95 and 95%, right? So if you use compatibility mode to open your .doc or .xls files, you should expect a success rate of all your old stuff opening it 95 to 99% of the time. It's great. However, storage savings can be really significant. I think our online documentation says you can save up to 75% of storage using the new file formats, right? So the new file formats, the OpenXML file types, is up to 75% smaller than the legacy binary file types. Well, what I've seen in production is between 50 and 60%. So what I tell customers is, if you're going to try and estimate what's the value, right? What's the point of converting all your old stuff, you should expect are estimating about a 50% storage savings. That can be significant. And that's where OMPM really comes into place, is you can actually determine, hey, does it make sense for me financially? Right? If I can save 683 gigabytes worth of network storage, is that enough of a cost savings to justify going through a document conversion project? Again, maybe, maybe not. If you have an environment where you are charging back storage, if the IT group charges the business for network storage, then you can very easily quantify, hey, here's the amount of savings I will save you per year if I convert, you know, convert some documents. So OMPM definitely can be used to identify low-risk files, right? And that's the point, is identify which files have a higher risk of data or format of function loss if I convert them, which files have no risk or very little risk of data or format or function loss. Right, so you can use that tool to help identify, well, which ones are good conversion candidates. Now, alternatively, if your goal is to reduce storage savings, what about using some type of archival approach? Right? A lot of times when I talk to customers about this, hey, you can get rid of stuff you've used, haven't used in 3-4 years. And sometimes they say, well, I haven't used it. Why am I keeping it around in my network? You may want to institute, and again, this is more strategic advice, if you have an archival approach where you can move really old stuff to lower cost storage, you may realize the same benefits as doing document conversion. And again, yeah, I said this earlier, your conversion should not be the end goal of deployment, right? Your goal of deploying Office 2010 is to get the new productivity benefits out of it, to be more productive, right? Please decouple document conversion as part of your deployment efforts. There is so much pain involved in converting your documents during a deployment that we definitely position it as an optional post-deployment step. The biggest challenge is broken links, right? If you convert a file, you're, in a sense, change the file name because you're converting that XLS file to XLSX. And if that file is referenced somewhere else via a linked document, it's now broken. And that generates a help desk call. And the tools can scan for those issues and really, you know, just try and avoid that as much as possible. All right, so using OMPM, definitely recommend it for the environment optimization phase, right? For your post-deployment, optional post-deployment tasks. Right, and you can also use the OMPM tool to identify, well, which files are low risk. Right, so you can use the filtering tool. And there's a little screenshot over there that identifies low risk files. So an example of low risk files are files that have green issues or no issues. And if you haven't used OMPM, Office Migration Planning Manager, there are five categories of issues. There's red issues, bad, right? Yellow issues, green issues. There's no issues, and then there's macro issues, which are separate. So you can say, hey, my low-risk files are ones that have identified that have either green issues, which are, in my opinion, so what issues, right? An Excel file has charts. Super. And our tool will identify that. Or files that have identified by the tool that have no issues, right? You may find that probably 70, 80% of your documents or of your environment has no issues. Files that haven't been modified recently. And that recently can be 30 days. It can be 100 days. And the reason you wouldn't want to convert stuff you've modified recently is it may appear in an application's MRU list, the most recently used list. So if you go to the file tab, then recent, you'll see all the stuff you used recently. Well, if you convert one of those files, again, you're changing the file extension. So what would happen, user clicks on that recently used file, generates an error, hey, I can't find it. May end up with a help desk call. And again, if you're trying to convert files as a means to save money, try and avoid those help desk calls. You can certainly quantify those. So avoid converting files that have been used recently. Also, files that don't have macro issues, right? You can say, okay, anything with a macro issue, you can just call it a high-risk file and not convert it. So here's an example using my, I'm not sure how well you can see that in the back, but I have 989 files here, and I've put my criteria, and I found 79% of my files are considered low risk. And now I can use the tools and figure out, hey, is it appropriate? What's the total storage used by that 79% of my files? And then determine, hey, does it make sense? So the steps for doing a bulk conversion are pretty straightforward. You've got to scan all your files. You import them into a database. You've got to create that SQL database. And then using the OMPM reporting tool, you can create that low-risk filter. And what you can do is on the previous shot, there is an export button. In the lower right, you can export all your files that you have explicitly identified as low risk, export that to one or more XML files. And you can use our OFC.exe tool, that is step 8, the second one from the bottom, to convert everything that's listed in that exported file. And in a sense, you're saying, I'm only going to convert files that I've explicitly identified as low risk. Now, before that, what you would want to do is determine, hey, what's your storage savings? And you can't do that in the OMPM reporting tool directly. You could copy and paste all the data from the reporting tool into Excel or Access, but that would be a pain in the butt. I've got a blog article that I put out that shows here's how you do it in SQL Management Studio. You just run a simple query. You can copy and paste it from the blog that says you can get a number. Here's the estimated storage savings of all my low-risk files. So before you can start converting file one, you can actually get a number. Is it worth it? Hey, boss, I can save us 2.3 terabytes worth of network storage. That may wake them up a lot, or it may say, okay, big deal. We got lots of money. Now, the challenge there is two of the last steps. When you convert a document using OFC, it's the same as doing a save as. Meaning, if you convert 1,000 documents using our bulk conversion tool, and your goal is to save storage costs and reduce storage needs, when you convert 1,000 files, you actually create 1,000 more files. Right? Because the OFC tool it creates a copy of the file and converts that copy. Right? Same as doing a save as. You're not replacing the existing file, you're creating a new one. So the challenge, if you're going to engage in a bulk conversion project, you need to make sure you have enough storage to handle all those copied files, all those converted files, and then you need to replace, do some type of cleanup activity. And you're going to be deleting the old files and replacing them with the converted ones. So if you're in the IT group, you may be thinking, ooh, that's risk. I'm converting other people's stuff, or I'm deleting other people's data. And definitely that certainly is the case. So you've got to take that risk into consideration when you're saying, hey, do I want to do bulk conversion? Now, you can the output, you can create some automation to help mitigate those risks and to automate the copying and the cleanup. But the OFC tool doesn't do that. It creates a copy, and then the cleanup is your responsibility. You can think of it two ways. Hey, that's great. Microsoft provided a tool that won't delete my stuff. Or hey, that stinks. I got more work to do. All right, so next is talking about your macro code. We really haven't talked about macros much today, because basically when people say, what do I do with my macros? You treat it just like any other of your Office solutions, right? End users don't see macros, generally. They see solutions, or sometimes they see documents with buttons, really. So they don't care, hopefully, does my document have a macro? Just, hey, does my solution work? So treating macros in a pre-deployment manner is the same you treat anything else. Figure out which solutions are important and proactively test those. And that comes to deprecated code. We have tools that will identify, hey, is there any code that has been deprecated from previous versions of the Office object model and all the Office applications, right? The challenge, though, or the benefit, I'm not sure the right way to say this, in Office terms, if you're using code that has been marked as deprecated from previous versions, it will still compile and it will still run in Office 2010, with the exception of one that I know of. The file search method is listed as deprecated, but it won't work. All the other items will. Right? So we have tools that will identify, hey, you've got lots of deprecated code. But again, so what? They will continue to work in Office 2010. What we're saying deprecated means is it may not work in future versions of Office. Right? It might not work in future versions. So there's no need to proactively test and remediate. Excuse me. There's no need to proactively remediate your deprecated code. Always test it. And I don't mean always test your macros. I mean if you identified things that are critical, you need to make sure you test your macro so to determine it works, right? We don't have tools that will say, my macro will not work. There's no tool that will say that unequivocally. You need to test your macros first to determine, hey, does it work? But again, I'm not recommending test everything, just if it's explicitly identified as critical. So, and that's where your deprecated code, because we're saying it might not work in future versions, if you've got critical solutions, and we have tools to help you identify which code has been deprecated, then you can start to say, hey, listen, these are things I want to help future-proof. I want to position these to better respond to change in the future. So I can identify what's deprecated and fix them at that point, after my deployment to Office 2010, right? This is an environment optimization task. And while we have tools, OMPM will identify which files have macro issues, and OCCI, which is the Office Code Compatibility Inspector, will give you an even more detailed view of which macros have issues. Not all issues captured by these tools are impactful. Right? So OMPM just gives you an aggregate number. It's saying you have 50 issues. It will not tell you are they deprecated. It will not tell you are they impactful at all. And it doesn't get you any closer to determining does my macro work. And the big reason why is, this is also something we put out on the blog article. In all the Office object models across Word, Excel, PowerPoint, Access, and Outlook, there are over 20,000 object model items. Right, 20,000. It's huge. And since going back all the way to Office 2000, right, so that's four versions, 2007, 2003, Office 2000, Office XP, and Office 2000, right, four versions, five applications, there are over 2,000 changes in the object model, right, and that's a big number. There are 2,000 changes, right, and some people may read that as, oh, 2,000 potential breakpoints in my macros. And we have tools that will help identify, hey, does your macro have any code that has been that is have a deprecated item or a changed item or removed item? The challenge is, of all those 2,000 changes, only 50 are impactful. And that's pretty significant, right? We have a one pager that says, here's the impactful items. Right? Deprecated items are not impactful. They're almost so what issues. In general, items that are marked as changed from previous object models, previous versions. Generally, the syntax of that item has changed, right? So the save as method may have an additional optional parameter. When a macro, if you've used the save as method and your only parameter of that method is save as this file name, and now you're using it in Office 2010 and there's additional optional parameters, you don't have to use those optional parameters. So over 95% of the items that are changed are not impactful. Items that are removed, definitely impactful, right? They could your code might not work. So our tools won't tell you if you run a tool. In fact, I had a conversation with a customer. They said they ran OCCI on their macros, found the removed item, or found, I can't remember what item it was. They said, ooh, I got to change that. They changed the code, and now their macro doesn't work as expected. They get different results. Hey, what's the problem with your tool? The first question I asked, oh, did the macro work beforehand? I said, we just ran the tool. So that was a big problem. They didn't say it like that. That's my generic sarcastic voice, apparently. And that's how we position OCCI, how we recommend using the OCCI tool. Test your macros first. And then if it doesn't work, you can use OCCI to help pinpoint why did it break. So OCCI won't tell you, will my macro break? It will tell you what might be the cause why it is broken. So it should not be used first. Do not use it in an effort to identify what macro will break. You can use it to help pinpoint why something might have broken already. So definitely test macros first rather than using tools. And all right, so key takeaways from today. Basically, the biggest thing is your discovery process. Partner with the business areas first. Do a user-centric approach to identifying what is critical. Right? IT groups have very little visibility into what Office solutions it takes to manage the business. You can use tools where appropriately, but make sure, oh, that's the last item there. Make sure your tools complement your compatibility project, your process, not the other way around. Don't lead with tools. Lead with process and support with tools. Because tools provide technical information, not business information. Make sure you're separating your tasks into pre-deployment and post-deployment activities, right? Pre-deployment, only focus on the stuff that are specifically are deployment enablers, things that are on the critical path to making sure I have to do this before I deploy. And make sure you can identify what's the business value of doing this. And then make sure you put your safety net in place. Right? If you can't do, if in some cases people say, I have a internally mandated date where I have to deploy Office by this time. I don't have time to find everything. What I would say to them, and I've had those conversations, okay, great, get your safety net in place. Use app virtualization. If you've got Semantics Workspace Virtualization or ThinApp or Microsoft's AppV, you create whatever you currently have, create a virtual package so you're prepared in case your users can't use the new environment for their specific solution. You've got that old environment in your back pocket, just in case. That's really going to help ease the transition, give your end users, the businesses, a bigger, better comfort level in your IT group to help enact change in your environment. And that's all I have. Oh, one thing, these are some other Office-related solutions, or excuse me, sessions this week. I wanted to point out the one that is highlighted that is Wednesday morning, 10:15. If you're interested in this, or even if you're not, there is a session, Office Deployment for the Elite. You want to learn more about deployment nuances and some really great ideas. Jeremy Chapman and Yoni Kirsch are delivering that on Wednesday morning. That would be a great session to go to. Finally, oh yeah, so we have some blog articles towards the bottom. The Office IT Pro blog is a location I blog to a lot. So a lot of the concept I talked about today, I go into a lot more technical detail, like using OMPM. What's it really good for? What's it not good for? I had to create a three-part series because there's so much stuff to talk about. There's an article just about the how to determine or understand the object model changes and if they're really impactful. Right, so there's a lot of good stuff out there. And there's also more stuff. Oh, yeah, here's the Tech Ed and all the different locations if you want to find more about Microsoft technologies. And lastly, please fill out evaluations. Cool, right. And you can win lots of great crap stuff, lots of great stuff. Sorry, yes, question. Planning for the new settings? How are you going to configure? Oh, so, okay, that's a good point. So the question was, what about planning all of the new settings? Right, so it's a good point. So what we were talking about today and focusing on is preparing for deployment, not configuring the deployment package, right? So all these steps are enabling you to deploy. What we've seen, Oh, yeah, actually, that's right. The session on Wednesday, thanks, Jeremy, the session on Wednesday is going to cover all the stuff that I didn't talk about. So this is kind of a lead-in to Jeremy and Yoni's session. 10:15 Wednesday, right? Yeah. Yes? Security? Yes, Group Policy Security Configuration Manager, yes. Yes? Oh, does anyone else have a question? Sorry. Yes? Can the tools we're installing SharePoint? Oh, yeah, they're in SharePoint libraries, yes. You can provide it a UNC path, drive letter, HTTP location. And my tag is no good. Let me get the right tag. And James, the mouse is gone again. Well, anyway, thank you very much for attending. And yeah, there's food soon. So thank you for your question. Thanks for coming. And again, please fill out your evaluations.